So I thought I might continue with a little more Ajahn Sucitto from Root Awakenings. This is some parts from Chapter 9, The Deathless Drum. Vasali was the site of many of the Buddha's teachings, and where, at the Kapila Shrine, he determined to let his life finish. They say the earth quaked. The accounts say that he would have held on to his life force until the end of the eon, if requested, but the faithful Ananda missed the chance. Here the Buddha, having just recovered from severe illness, 80 years old and worn, said that he would pass away after 3 months. Ripe I am in years, my life spans determined. Now I go from you, having made myself my refuge. Bhikkhus, be untiring, mindful, disciplined, guarding your minds with well-collected thought. He who, tireless, keeps Tadhamma and Vinaya, leaving birth behind, will put an end to dukkha. To us, Vasali seemed like a good place for a rest and for the all-night meditation vigil of the full moon of December. We reckoned on needing a day or so to regenerate some energy for the vigil. Therefore, we had pushed the pace a little to get there a couple of days before the full moon. Nick had the information that the only vihara in Vasali was a temple of the Nipponzan Myohoji sect. Being Japanese, it was bound to be quiet and clean. The last miles on the road seemed endless. We had been going vigorously with only brief pauses for about 11 hours since Mr. Singh's protracted breakfast. We hadn't even stopped for food. The sun had long gone down, and the monotonous road and the rhythm of walking had merged into a hologram of fatigue in which the mind lost the ability to measure time or distance. There was just the pounding of the road and the mantra leading onward like some unstoppable dirge. We were so numb and vastly so small that we might have stomped past it in the dark but for a rectangular expanse of dark water wherein blazed the great moon. And the small white temple was right beside it, white and cool and still, a neat notice on its gate, and inside an immaculate shrine with great glowing Buddhas and a photo of the founder of the Nipponzan Myohoji, Reverend Nichidatsu Fuji, on the shrine. A broad smile beamed over his hands joined in Anjali to greet us. Fluffy white eyebrows danced like cirrus clouds above a face shining with well-being. The drum that played a central part in their ritual stood to one side of the shrine. We paid our respects and waited for the host. At the time of the Buddha, Vasali was the capital of the Lichavi Republic, which together with the Republic of the Widehas made up of the Vajjian Confederacy. They say that the Buddha was impressed with Vasali. It was a beautiful spot, and the people who lived there had a form of government that was democratic by nature, being made up of leaders elected from the aristocratic class. It probably reminded him of his homeland, which was ruled in a similar way. However, although the Buddha had no illusions about the pride and stubbornness of his own people, he had nothing but praise for the Lichavis. Unlike his own people, they had offered him hospitality at the numerous shrines in their republic and had taken to heart his advice on statecraft. Once when I was at the Sarananda shrine in Vasali, I taught the Vajjans these 7 principles for preventing decline. And as long as they keep to these 7 principles, as long as these principles remain in force, the Vajjans may be expected to prosper and not decline. The Buddha also directly related the 7 principles to the harmonious functioning of the spiritual fraternity. Briefly stated, that advice was the following: to meet frequently, to meet in harmony, carry out business in harmony, and depart in harmony, to refrain from authorizing what has not been authorized, and not to abolish what had been authorized, to honor and respect the elders and listen to their advice, to maintain good conduct with regard to women, to honor and respect their holy places, and to look after spiritual sages. These 7 principles, the Buddha assured the chief minister of Magadha, would make the Vajjians impossible to defeat should Ajatasattu the aggressive king of Magadha waged war on them. For the Sangha, the Buddha modified these principles to include exhortations to live simply in the forest, to sustain mindfulness, to avoid getting caught up in building projects, to avoid too much social chit-chat, to share what everyone had with fellow samanas, and so on. With this way of living, the Buddha reminded his disciples the Sangha might be expected to prosper and not to decline. With these principles established and the many teachings he had given, the Buddha felt that he could pass away, with encouragement to his disciples to live as lanterns unto yourselves, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dhamma as your lantern and refuge, with no other refuge. Soon after the Buddha's demise, the Vajrayans were conquered by Ajatasattu. Paying heed to the Buddha's word to them, the king employed a strategy of infiltrating agents who stirred up discord amongst the Lichavis. With their harmony gone, they were easy prey. However, the Sangha is still around, at least in an outward form. The Vinaya's requirement that the Sangha discusses its business in an assembly and makes its decisions by unanimous consent has held it together. There are also large-scale meetings. 100 years or so after the death of the Buddha, the Sangha Council met at Vaisali to come to an agreement over some matters of discipline. And this, which has subsequently been called the Second Buddhist Council, continued a tradition of large-scale meetings on such matters that has gone on ever since. The sixth was held in 1954. So despite the fact that gaining support from established secular powers throughout Asia has rendered the Sangha vulnerable to the corruptions of wealth and power, wherever there is a teaching and a training in accordance with the seven principles, a Sangha community manifests in an authentic way. The Vinaya training was something that I was particularly conscious of and grateful for, having spent the first couple of years as a bhikkhu with very little understanding of Sangha life. Ajahn Sumedho, whom I subsequently met by chance in northern Thailand, had on the other hand received a superb spiritual education from the forest master, Venerable Ajahn Chah, and it showed, in terms of patience, kindness, and the ability to let go, things much easier said than done. Our paths had crossed again when I returned to England and found him carrying out the traditional bhikkhu training in a townhouse in London. Strangely enough, the Vinaya made even more sense there, outside of a Buddhist culture. If you don't fully understand the aims of the training, life as a bhikkhu seems a meaningless anachronism. You lose perspective on what the symbol of the renunciant stands for and brings into the world. Most bhikkhus who have not cultivated the discipline reflectively go off the rails or disrobe when coming to the West, and I got pretty close myself. If it had not been for Ajahn Sumedho's example, I would never have developed the scope of my practice beyond that of meditation exercises. But the Buddha taught a complete way of life. The Vinaya's steady light had made it possible to live this uncertain life as a pilgrimage. Now it was guiding us around the Buddha's land. The scrupulousness, the renunciation, and the fellowship that it engendered were the reason and the means whereby I came to be here. Vinaya was a way of enhancing beautiful qualities: care of the sick, respect for the elders, support of lay followers, the honor of serving the Dhamma. The Sangha at Vaisali was currently Reverend Reiji Nakazoto and an Indian attendant. The Japanese monk's English was not great, but about as good as ours was in our evening brain-dead state. Polite silences and gestures and tea seemed very pleasant. He had received my letter from Lumbini. It seemed that people did not normally stay at the temple, but as I was a monk. Unfortunately, the temple was about to undertake a 7-day regime of refraining from eating and drinking, so there would be no food as of tomorrow. According to Japanese tradition, the Buddha was enlightened on December 8th, and so they fast during the immediate preceding week. Well, that was great timing on our part. Not even water. No water, he explained, but on the fourth day they took some noodle mush and green tea to clean out the system. And the regime would include a continual drumming and mantra recitation from an hour before dawn until an hour after sunset. Of course, we were not obliged to join in, but next morning we found that joining in was hardly a matter of choice. Womp, 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 womp. Nam yo ho renge kyo, nam yo ho renge kyo. The shrine room of the tiny temple was on the other side of the wall from our beds. Drumming being the support for the principal practice of Nipponzan Myohoji, the drum was huge and attended with all the fervor it takes to sustain a 7-day fast or a 1,000-mile peace pilgrimage, also a major part of their practice. Or to construct beautiful peace pagodas in places throughout the world, all done with total self-sacrificing commitment. People pointed askance to the huge scars that many of the monks bore as a result of strapping bundles of incense to their arms, setting fire to them, and sustaining the burning of their own flesh by fanning the glowing joss sticks. This apparently was an act of penance, or of offering of their lives to the Buddha. Not what the Buddha taught, people say, but the drum and the mantra override that. Womp, 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 womp. Nam yo ho renge kyo, nam yo ho renge kyo. Womp, womp, womp. And when your head is a few feet away from it, there's not a lot of room for thought. The skin vibrates with the rhythm, whether the thinking joins in or not. According to Nichiren, the monk teacher who established this mantra practice in 13th century Japan, Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, homage to the white lotus of the good law, is the heart of the Buddha's teaching, and you can forget the rest. Drumming certainly makes forgetting very easy. During our stay in Vaisali, Buddhist activity could be summed up as the dawn breaking with the mantra and the sun setting to the pounding of the drum. For the first day, activity of any kind was minimal. We lay there being pounded for a few hours until Nick dredged up the motivation to go and search for food. He returned some hours later, having had to sit down and rest every 100 yards or so with the snacks that he had bought in the nearby market. I don't remember the rest of the day, except that as a gesture of harmony, we decided to join in the mantra sessions for the hour before dawn and the hour after sunset every day. It helped us maintain a fitting forgetfulness. The drummers were still going strong into their second day as we made it out of the temple to a chai shop down on the main road. The drumming, although resounding over the entire area, was less dominant there, and Indian life was meandering along, oblivious to the spiritual energy that was relentlessly resounding. There was a tourist information office with old posters on the wall and a few brochures about Varanasi and Uttar Pradesh. We had seen that there was a museum on the other side of the tank, and we already had a map showing the site of an ancient stupa. The museum was closed, and we didn't have the energy to get out to the stupa. Nick ambled off to survey a mound. I slowly made it back to the temple to write a letter to the Sangha at Amaravati until after sunset. Salutations to the white lotus continued to pour forth. Nyam mo ho renge kyo, nyam yo, nam yo ho renge kyo, and womp, 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 womp. We were all sitting in the shrine room before the glowing Buddhas. It was not yet dawn on the third thumping day. The Japanese monk was at the big drum. The Indian, apparently training for the monkhood, was using a small handheld disc over which a skin was stretched. The mantra painted on the skins in beautiful Japanese calligraphy danced to the rhythmic pounding. You had to hand it to them. They weren't holding anything back. The drumsticks lunged into the skins as the mantra roared, rasping out of their throats time and time again. The pounding was in unison. The drawn-out moan of the mantra gripped now the Indian, now the Japanese, while the other sucked in air. Were they chanting for world peace or for enlightenment? Whatever the apparent purpose, it justified itself as a manifestation of single-mindedness and energy. Whether it led to transcendence, you'd have to find out for yourself. I found the implications of that resolve and that unreasoning energy behind it rather frightening. The Karsavek we had seen at Lucknow station had that kind of energy in a less organized way. Then there were the suicide squads and martyrs who made a purpose into a cause. Human will has an alarming power. Nick joined in, but to me it wasn't the kind of thing I could do without meaning. So I sat in my Theravada non-alignment, listening, feeling the energy, and meditating on it. Meditation, wrote Most Reverend Fuji in one of the books around the temple, was a self-centered waste of time. The real practice was the mantra and the bringing forth of Buddha energy into the world. This was what would bring around world peace. The Reverend Master had undertaken incredible austerities, was greatly admired by Gandhi, and had presided over an order that was responsible for the construction of dozens of peace pagodas throughout Japan, Europe, India, North America, and Africa. However, my little Theravada mind sniffed that it didn't seem like Buddhism to me. But to each his own. For us, December 2nd was the day of the full moon observance, the end of our first month on pilgrimage. I managed to rally my Theravada principles and strike out the numbness to fare for alms in the next village, Chakramdas. It wasn't difficult to walk in the slow, composed manner prescribed by the training rules. Actually, it was quite pleasant to be gently wading through eddies of children. When I had made it to the end of the village and decided to give up, they beckoned me on, to a house where a young man wearing Western clothes came out to meet me. Ah, I understood. He was the one in the village who spoke the best English. Come into my house and I will put something into your pot. It was more than something. After tea and a long conversation, it was a whole meal, specially cooked and served on a stainless plated dish. Some of the advice to the Lichavis seemed to be in good working order, but in general, the picture was of decay. Like many educated Indians, he had no job, but had enough education to know of the appalling economic statistics of this part of the world. 80 million people in Bihar, with nearly half of the population below the poverty line, defined as the amount needed to buy food giving 2,100 calories per day, was an example of the figures that occupied my host's mind. And having no equation for happiness other than the one that materialism presented, he was in a more depressed state than the poor villagers. It was good that my presence at least revitalized his Dhamma in terms of hospitality and presented a different way of measuring life. He said, "Tomorrow you must bring your friend. I will show you around the sights." I returned to the temple feeling rather pleased with this small boost for the practice of asamana. Nick was also more invigorated and reckoned that, as tonight was our all-night meditation vigil, the intelligent thing would be to get an hour or so's rest. We moved out into the backyard to stretch out somewhere where a clump of bushes offered meager shade and the drumbeat was less tangible than inside. It didn't work. That was as far as my Buddha energy could go. Another afternoon of being pounded left us with the vigor of a couple of aged teddy bears. So much for the all-night meditation. My stuffing was all out even before midnight, leaving me just enough wit to recognize that being slumped against the wall was no more of a vigil than lying on a bed. You could call that a direct realization. At times, Most Reverend Fuji's assessment of meditation practice, although not quite in accord with the scriptures, summed up my attempts quite well. The day the drums stopped was a sad day. When I could actually think more clearly, Vaisali struck me with a kind of pathos. The fact that it had been a place where the Buddha gave some seminal teachings on the survival of his way in the future meant that I kept relating the city's decline to the decline of the Triple Gem in its birthplace. This was the place where the Buddha first summarized his teachings as sila, samadhi, and panya, the definition that is the bedrock of Buddhism. And here, worn out and encouraging his disciples to take responsibility for themselves, to practice the Dhamma for their own and others' welfare, was where he left his alms bowl and began the journey north to his death place. Now the barest relics are left. The Buddha's bowl had occupied a hallowed shrine until the Emperor Kanishka removed it in the 2nd century CE. According to the sutta, the Lichavis obtained an eighth portion of the Buddha's remains and enshrined them in a stupa at Vaisali. The sutta's account was confirmed by the pilgrim Sun Xiang, who visited when Vaisali's ruins were more extensive. He even added that the Emperor Asoka had opened the stupa, taken out 9/10 of the relics to put in other stupas, and left the 10th portion and rebuilt the stupa. Nobody made much of all that until the remnants of the stupa were discovered in 1958. In the heart of the rubble was a small soapstone reliquary containing burnt bone. The ruin itself, which we visited after the museum, consisted of an ancient earth core that had been enlarged with bricks on several occasions and showed signs of having been opened about 250 years after its construction. But now, even that reliquary had been taken away from Vaisali. According to the museum, the relics, along with anything of archaeological interest, were now in Patna Museum. All that remained here were a few lumps of stone delineating where the stupa had stood. It had held the Enlightened One's remains for 2,000 years, and now it looked like the decayed molar in the jaw of something long since dead. In the falling dusk, I placed some of the offerings I had brought from England into the empty heart of the stupa, then circumambulated it with lit candles and incense. Tea with our host on his rest day was a pleasant relief for everybody. Nick and I talked to him about Buddhism in Britain, and we were excited to hear that the relics from the Buddha's cremation, although not on show, could be seen if one obtained special permission from the director of the museum in Patna. Strangely enough, he had never got round to pursuing the possibility himself. The next morning, it was back to the drum. We sat in for the last time, and as the night sky paled, left the throbbing temple and headed over the long bare mound to the southeast. Nick was telling me all about it, but I wasn't interested. All this dead stuff seemed beside the point. There was a story that Buddha told about a drum, a great drum that had not been properly looked after. Eventually, the drum head rotted and only the pegs remained. The drum was unable to sound. This will happen to the Dhamma, the Buddha warned, if the Sangha does not keep the teachings and the suttas well learned. These teachings and the Vinaya were his bequest. Leaving Vaisali for the last time, the Enlightened One had turned and given it a long, fond look, his final blessing. Striding across that mound in the gray dawn, I couldn't bring myself to do the same. Better to keep going and stay with the walking. He quotes the Buddha. And how does a monk live as a refuge unto himself? Here, Ananda, a monk abides contemplating the body as body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, and having put away all hankering and fretting for the world, and likewise with regard to feelings, mind, and mind objects.
Any questions, comments? That actually brought up memories of myself and Ajahn Sara arriving at Rajgir just as they were starting the same chanting session. Right, this is early December. But we only spent one night there, and they arranged for us to stay at their original place. In Rajgir, they've got three places. One just on the other side of the bamboo grove, one kind of closer to a little town or hamlet, and then another large one on the top of Vulture's Peak. On the top of the mountain where Vulture's Peak is. They arranged for us to stay at the little place, and nothing was happening there. It was very quiet. Mm-hmm. But we, of course, we joined the chanting up on top of can't remember the name of the mountain, but up further, higher than Fortress Peak. And but anyway, yeah, the thought. They definitely go for it.
Yes. Any thoughts about relating to, there's a lot of, especially contemplating, such long spans of time and the decline of Varanasi. There's a lot comes up. Any suggestion, just picking apart the, sort of samvega from sadness that just doesn't have much purpose?
Well, I mean, one of the things is paying attention to the how it can easily drift into sadness and certain frustration. Why is the world like this? But it's really fun. It's the way it is. So. But then also reflecting back on the principles that the Buddha himself laid down and realized, well, you can't make the world conform to the Buddhist principles, but we can, say individually, we can try to manifest those principles and as a community, we can try to do it as best we can. Yeah. And realizing that those principles are timeless and, that's a source of inspiration. So yes, there is a recognition of the inevitable change, dissolution, and there's a naturalness to that. But within that, there's also these principles that you can encourage yourself with.
So to, on a little more materialistic or worldly level, yes, it's true that it sort of died out in the homeland, but like you said, that's the way of the world. One of the unique parts about Buddhism, in comparison to maybe other religious spiritual systems, is the lack of dependence on a specific holy area.
Yeah.
And of course, that's actually strengthened Buddhism in a way I think is fairly unique. We have, of course, the Pali Canon, but also Chinese dogmas, Sanskrit fragments, Tibetan fragments. I mean, one of the largest corpuses of most ancient documents and the best meditation instructions in history.
Right.
Somebody, somewhere, groups of many, many thousands of people, millions of people, kept those teachings alive with the seven principles.
Okay.
They may not have been in India. They were in India, and they were in many other places as well.
Yes.
It's really inspiring to know that we have all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really, really true. That's the strength of Buddhism is it's in the principles that are not necessary to be focused on a particular place or even center or hierarchy even. We don't have a Vatican to prop up or a center of Islam, center of Judaism. There's all these places that people sort of fight over. That doesn't exist really. In Buddhism as well. But even the holy places now that are sort of seen as great centers, that's a fairly recent phenomenon. That's kind of the revived. It has certainly a value to it, but it hasn't been propped up. In fact, if anything, they were totally neglected.
And something I really appreciate about I hear it time and time again from different guru ajahns or people relating stories from guru ajahns about, you don't have to go to India.
Yeah.
That's not where it is.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, in addition to just being right on, it's so encouraging and affirmative.
Yeah, the teaching and the training is what keeps, is what's at the core. So those the fundamentals of right view and right practice are what is so important. And if you go to India to pilgrimage, it isn't, you don't get any special juice from there other than a reminder that you right view and right practice. Okay.